My mom is nervously pacing the living room back and forth, back and forth. Every other step she unties and reties her crimson work apron. My brother and I were instructed to stay on the couch. And as my mom continues to pace, my younger brother kicks me. So I do what every 8-year-old bigger brother does. I kick him right back. My mom continues her pace, clutching the phone in her hands. My dad is an hour late picking us up. My mom's now late for her second shift at work, and we're late for the Denver Broncos game at Mile High Stadium. So I reach my hand around my brother, flick his ear as hard as I can. His face turns red, red as a tomato, and he just starts in with straight punches to me. Do I respond with a big tackle? My mom's breaking us up in front of the couch when my dad's truck pulls up in front of our townhome. He honks the horn. He gives a big smile like he's not a second late for anything. We run outside, get in the truck, and we go to the football game. We park, and my younger brother, an entrepreneur from the very beginning, leads my dad into the Denver Broncos gift shop, plays on the guilt of the hour straight, and in less than 15 minutes, we are dressed in Broncos swag. Jerseys, sweatshirts, hats, everything you could imagine, but especially for us, the Denver Broncos number one fan, foam fingers. My dad rolls his eyes as we walk out of the gift shop and we're hitting one another with our foam fingers. So we finally get to our seats. The second quarter of the football game is almost over and we're starving, of course. So we look at my dad and my dad throws his hands up in the air and we get nachos and hot dogs and three big things of cotton candy. And we even talked him into ice cream after all that was done. So the game ends and we're the happiest 8-year-old and 6-year-old in the stadium. And the Broncos won 31-21 against the Oakland Raiders. And as we drive home, my dad has a couple stops to make for work, a couple construction sites that need attention. And we get home late. Later than expected, because remember, it's Sunday night and we have school the next day. My mom is nervously pacing the living room. The next thing I know, I wake up and my mom is scrubbing the cotton candy off my face. And her and my dad are in a heated exchange about what time we were supposed to be home. And my dad leaves. And then I see the tear on my mom's cheek drops onto mine and I feel her heart break as we're in that living room. And my heart breaks a little. She didn't know and didn't expect that her relationship with my dad would go this way. She didn't know that it would be like this for her sons. For the next 8 years, this would be the pattern. Their miscommunication. Sometimes he would show up, sometimes he wouldn't. But all the while in this situation, my dad, Wayne Fredrickson, was my hero. He was a larger-than-life figure. He had blue eyes that sparkled at you. He had a big smile. He had a contagious laughter about him. Everyone wanted to be Wayne's friend. The moment he came into a room, he was the leader of that room. It was amazing to watch. His laughter compelled people to join him on whatever cause he had going on. Some of the favorite stories that I have heard from my dad were in North Glen, the very same town that I grew up in as well. My dad was on the All-Star Little League team, and he hit 2 home runs in the World Series to win it for the North Glen team. My dad also, not only did he have batting skills, but he had pitching skills. He was a super athlete on top of his leadership abilities. So that, as he grew in his life, he played football at North Glen High School. He was featured in the paper. His senior year, he was the tight end for the North Glen Norsemen, and he caught 18 passes that year. He went on to get a scholarship to Mesa State, where he had the opportunity to play baseball or football. He loved the sport part, but didn't like the school part, so he did what everyone does. He joined the Navy. And in the Navy, he soon became a Navy SEAL. And during his time as a Navy SEAL, he developed colitis, inflammation of the colon, and was honorably discharged from his duties. So that's when I came into the world. And at this time, I remember my dad had a gift for working with wood. And we built my mom this beautiful oak drawer, Chester drawers. It was just a beautiful set. And as he worked with wood more and more, he built these grandfather clocks that my grandpa and him built. He had a gift for working, for building things. So he became a construction superintendent. And he built big buildings in Colorado. This is a building early on in his career. And it made the natural sense for the next step of his career to start his own construction company. This logo, Fredrickson Construction Incorporated, it was a logo that I got to see at high schools around our city, at big building projects. My dad was my hero. And every time I saw this logo and thought about my dad, I had this sense of pride inside. This is my dad. My dad also was very proud to tell you he was one of the first owners of Motorola's brand new cell phone called the Brick. If you remember, the battery life was exactly 1 hour when it came out. And my dad was sure to brag about this. In fact, one time I remember as going with his personality, he was like, "Do you want to order a pizza?" And I was like, "We don't have a phone." He pulls it out and orders a pizza right there on the spot. My dad was a character. What he lacked in his parental skills, he made up in his charismatic personality and love for all. My mom and my dad just could not communicate their differences. And so my mom finally took my dad to court over child support issues. And the story, I love the way my dad tells it. My dad tells a story the way he said it is, my mom's female lawyer was a, insert the appropriate non-church word right here, we're going to use not nice lady for purposes of the presentation. So this not nice lady is giving it to the judge, really just calling my dad out on not being there, on child support that wasn't paid, and going on and on and on. Finally, my dad gets the opportunity to defend himself. And instead of making an argument, he decides to, in line with his character, direct his comments directly at the female lawyer. So he stands there, and caveat to the story, this is the day before Valentine's Day. So he looks at her and he says, "If you don't play nice, you're not going to get a Valentine's Day date." At that point, the lawyer slams the gavel, demands that he pay the child support, and not only did he pay the child support, that he pay all my mom's legal fees the very next day before 5 p.m. So my dad, being my dad, decides he's going to make this a special event for Valentine's Day for this not nice female lawyer. So what he decides to do, it was over $400 in fees that were owed to this lady. He decided to go to every bank in town and to get pennies for the exact dollar amount. He took a dolly with this huge box of pennies, and then he said to her in a note, "Be my Valentine," and dropped it at her office. My dad was my hero. The way he could bring life and light to situations, the way his contagious laughter could change a room was amazing to me. He was a charismatic man. And after this event happened in my life, with the penny incident, I call it, I noticed that some things began to change in my dad. He began to grow. He became more consistent, especially when I was in junior high. Every Thursday morning, he took his boys to Village Inn, and we talked about life. We shared. what was going on with us. And then every other weekend he had us, and he began to take more serious his call as a dad. And then he announced to us that we were going to Las Vegas. So before I started high school, we went to Las Vegas and chilled by the Luxor pool with my dad. It was a highlight in my life, one of those rare bonding experiences that don't happen every day. About a month later, still on the buzz of this incredible time with my dad, the heartbreak came. We got a call from my dad on October 31st, 1994, and he basically told me with a lifelessness in his voice that I had never heard that he had been diagnosed with colon cancer and that he was going to scale back his work at the construction company, that he wanted to spend more time with his boys, and he regretted the time he didn't spend. And we did get to spend some time with him. It was much shorter than we expected. But on November 24th, 1994, he passed away. This jarred my world. Your dad, your 6'2", 235-pound, athletic, charismatic dad, is not supposed to die. That's not in the script of life. It was not as if someone was stepping on my chest. It was as if hundreds of pounds of weight were upon me. It was like the world was drained of all color. The next days and months were filled with pain and grief for me. In this season of my life, I felt this tension inside of me. I felt this heartbreak like nothing I can describe for you. My mom pacing back and forth, thinking of ways she could help her boys. How was she going to help these spirited boys to handle something like this? She goes into a church, and she finds that classic 1990s clip art with verse Psalm 62:5 written on it. The psalm is a God poem that says, "I depend on God alone. I put my hope in him. Trust in God at all times, my people." And the next line is my favorite. "Pour out your hearts before God, for God is a refuge for us." So my mom comes home with this little poster with that psalm written on it and hands it to me as if this was something magical that could help me in this time of grief. And I was nice, and I put it on my wall in my room, and I didn't think much about it. But those words had a way of working on me. Those words were reading me. And for the next days and months, those words ricocheted around my head. "I depend on God alone. I put my hope in him." And as I said them day after day after day, mainly because I made the mistake of putting that darn poster right by the door as I exited. So I had to see that darn poster. And as I kept saying those words over and over, I began to sense a little bit of the grief lifting. I began to sense that I wasn't just saying those words, I was starting to pray those words. I was starting to question, to say why, to cry out for a real refuge from this pain, to start to understand why this happened to my family. At about that time, I like to think that that verse opened my heart to the possibility of what church could be. And my best friend on the basketball team, he invited me to come to their small little church near North Glen, Colorado. And I went because I needed the church. I needed some hope and some life and some light. So I go to this church, and you would not believe it. Those people there hug each other. Those people there give each other handshakes. Those people ask you how you are doing, and they really mean it. It's not as if they're perfect people, but there's a love that oozes from them that's not from this world. So I began going to this small little church, and after a while, I found myself going week after week. These people received me. I belonged to that church before I believed a word of what Christianity had to say to us through hospitality and love I was received by that great little small church. And Kevin's mom, Vicki Knutson, gave me a gift, a 2,412-page navy blue study Bible. It had my name etched on the cover. It had the books of the Bible in small tabs. She even got me a little carrying case. And as I started to crack open that book, to see what it had to say to me, to see and learn about a God of love, a God who could love us and restore us and help us to grieve through life's worst. She tutored me. She nurtured me through the process. I remember reading the book of Job with her. I was interested in this man who suffered so much, and she was patiently outlining the chapters, teaching me how the flow of the book could work. She nurtured me in the church. Then, as I grew and as the years went by, it was a slow process. And I still have days where I doubt and struggle and ask deep questions. But I felt the church meet me in my time of need. Another verse that was one of my favorites, it echoes throughout the Old Testament, and it comes first in Exodus 32:4. It says, the Lord, a God of compassion and grace, he does not easily get angry, but abounds in steadfast love and faithfulness. What I found in the church and with the people of the church is a God of love. A God that day after day pours forth love into our hearts, hope into our hearts, begins to transform our mind, that our world is drenched in God's love for everyone. No one is a nobody in the church. Then I began to be invited more and more to different leadership opportunities, times to share my story, times to grow in who I was as a person, times that called me to step out of who I was to do something more for someone else. At about this time, I went to Colorado Christian University, and at the time I was there, it was full of great Bible and theology professors, and they had me read a little book by John Howard Yoder called The Politics of Jesus. This book, for me, began to open up the idea that Christianity isn't an otherworldly phenomenon, but a this-worldly. Jesus is calling for us to have a paradigm shift, to look at our world through different lenses. Jesus is asking us to let love be the anthem of our life, because in Jesus' new way of thinking of the world, love replaces hate, forgiveness replaces long-standing grudges, compassion replaces judgment, and service replaces greed. So as I began to become a disciple, a follower of the way of Jesus, the paradigm shift takes us a lifetime to put inside our heart, inside our mind. I began to feel this urging, this calling, that my life was called to do something more, to, holy cow, become a pastor of a church and somehow help this great mission statement to go towards more and more people in our neighborhood, in our community, and in our world. My life is the story of heartbreak and homecoming. When I lost my dad, I didn't think that anything could be worse. But when I found the church, or when the church found me and God's love saturated my heart, my life began to change. Shortly after I started the ordination process, Stacy and I moved to Anaheim, California. In Anaheim, I met this young man named Martin Zendejas. Martin was a neighborhood kid at Anaheim United Methodist Church, and through a series of encounters, I was able to invite him to all that the church had to offer him, and I watched this young man's life transform before my eyes. I watched his love fill his heart, and he became a new creation in Christ. One day, we're driving back from a youth event, and Martin says to me, So, Dale, what's it take to, you know, do this pastor thing? So I respond to him of just, well, you know, my process has been I have to go through the ordination process, and I had to get a BA in biblical studies and an MDiv, and then I did some PhD coursework because I cared about the teaching. And then he looks me straight in the eye, as sincere as could be, and he says, Dale, you could have been somebody, man. And I look him straight in the eye and I say, Martin, the church transformed my life. There is no place I'd rather be than right here with you, helping you to follow the way of Jesus, helping you to be invited to the church's great mission. I wonder, what's your story? Where have you encountered the transformation of the great mission statement of the church? I wonder where God may be inviting you to give to the transformation of the world and of our great church. Amen.